Hey, everybody, welcome to the Aligned Love Podcast. This is the place where I am going to help you find the one thing that you feel is missing, healthy love. I am your host, Lauren Zoller, and in this podcast, I will share with you how to attract love, live in alignment, and elevate your deepest relationships. So buckle up, get present, tune into your body, and open up to the possibility that you truly do get to have it all. Let's dive in. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Align Love Podcast. I have a very exciting interview for you today. One of my dear friends, Will Reason, is on the show. Will is an expert in helping high-level industry leaders transform their life and career through deep, powerful inner work. His clients are some of the world's top coaches and massive names in internet marketing. He has worked with Emmy Award winners, TED speakers, medical directors, global philanthropists, artists, teachers, and Fortune 500 developers. And over the past 18 years, Will has immersed himself in studying human development through the lens of culture, psychology, biology, physiology, somatics, mysticism, myth, and behavioral change. He is trained in many models, including somatic experiencing, core energy leadership coaching, karmic astrology, Amazonian shamanism, and much more. He is a wealth of knowledge, and Will integrates a multitude of therapeutic models into his work with clients and when teaching his students. Will is one of my mentors. I am really excited to share his knowledge with you. So without further ado, let's jump in and chat with Will. Will, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lauren.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So excited that everybody gets to hear your knowledge today. I always like to start the Align Love podcast with setting an intention. So I'm actually going to hand the mic over to you to set the intention for what you would like the listeners to just kind of open their minds to as you and I have a conversation today.
You know, if I were to offer an intention for today, it would be that you, the listener, is present with yourself throughout the conversation. And that you have an insight or learn something new about yourself or about your partner or about the people that you love. Mm-hmm. And that could translate to something new in your life.
Love it. Presence.
Presence.
Such a big one. So good. Love it so much. I mean, that's the essence of our work. So I'm sure we're going to be diving into a lot of that. But before we kind of jump into what we're going to talk about today, because I want to geek out a little bit on SE. I know that before the show started, we were talking about psychedelics and how you can use that on your healing journey properly and improperly. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Yep. But before we jump in, I just want to hear a little bit about your story, because I know bits and pieces, and I know that you grew up, I believe your mother was a therapist, correct?
She is a therapist, but wasn't while I was a child. Where would you like me to start in the journey? Because I can... Depending on how much time we have, I can start early and kind of go through teenage stuff, or we can do young adulthood. It's entirely up to you. I don't mind.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to know your whole story because you are the most fascinating human on the planet. But let's just start. Like, I would love to know the journey of discovering your own body's wisdom and what that path looked like, which for me, like I know for me, it started really young. But with knowing that, start where you feel is aligned for you.
Well, I'll give you kind of a snapshot of different layers of life. I have fond memories of my childhood, really fond memories. I was born into a conservative Christian household. Both my parents were really religion or spirituality, maybe I should say. It was really important to both of them. My mother's father is an Episcopal priest, or was. He's retired now. And her brother is also now a priest, and his son is a monk. So spirituality is pretty heavily embedded in her family lineage. And my father really wanted to be a minister or a priest when I was a child. So I was born into this household where mystery and spirituality and the unseen was a part of the context. Now, my mother was an art teacher when I was a child. So she really encouraged creativity along with imagination. She told stories, fairy tales, you know, alongside of the more biblical stories. And they fostered my creativity and imagination in a myriad of ways. She was a stay-at-home mom, four a number of years during my childhood. And that meant she homeschooled me at times. At two, I had a brother. And one of my first memories, well, it's my second memory, is my brother being born. And it's still just as vivid today as it was when I was younger. And, you know, many memories fade, but I guess, you know, we can say explicit memory starts to form when the hippocampus begins forming, or, you know, is formed, I believe, if I'm not correct. I'm not a brain scientist, but I believe that's how the sequence of things goes. So that must have been relatively early for me, because I remember my second birthday. It was a birthday party. We lived outside of Springfield, Massachusetts, in the Berkshire Mountains. And then about 3 months later, my brother was born. And I have these memories of playing on this construction equipment. One of my mother's close friends was there with me. And so he was born in a midwife's home instead of at the hospital. And so I have these memories of coming in, and my mother's in labor on this large bed. And, you know, there's a lot of blood and she's making a lot of noise. And then I have memories of being in the bathtub with her and my brother after he's born, and holding him after being born.
Wow.
And I remember being so happy and excited about that. So early memories, right? And as we were growing up, there's a lot of love in our home. There was a lot of softness, gentleness, and nurturing at that time period in my life. And like I said, they fostered imagination. And once I learned how to read, I became a voracious reader. I mean, I just would just read and read and read. I think at like 8 or 9, I was reading Tolkien.
Oh my gosh.
Or Lord of the Rings or whatever it was. I was really young reading this stuff. And she had books on history and ancient cultures and fairy tales, like the Russian fairy tales, the dark ones.
The dark ones.
And I loved that stuff. And I lived kind of in between these two worlds, the grounded world that we're in, but also in my imagination a lot as a child. And you could say I was a dreamer. I was artistic. I was really, really smart. I could do those memory games with like 100 tiles and get them all right. It was wild. I don't have that kind of sharpness in my brain these days. But as a child, I was super high IQ. And she fostered that creativity. I actually heard a study once that it was done over, it was like a 30-year study or something like that. And you may know what I'm referencing here, but testing kindergartners for their IQ. We're going to tangent for a moment and then come back to my story. It was something like 75% of them tested in genius level or something like that. Or maybe the percentage was higher.
Yeah.
Retesting in middle school, the percentage dropped by 30-40%. And then retesting in high school or college, it was down to something like 3-5%. Now, I may have the percentages wrong here, but the purpose is to illustrate that this is trained out of us. The kind of creative abstract thinking that most of us have as children is trained out of us, either in school or socially or by our parents or, you know, by our cultures. So as a child, that was really fostered for me. And I tell that part of the story right now because I think that laid the foundation for how I'm able to have abstract connections between a variety of different topics and disciplines. And I can synthesize those together. Mm-hmm. And that shows up in the work that I do with people. So I always had an interest in culture. I always had an interest in myth. What are the myths that hold the different cultures together? I was interested in ancient Egyptian cultures. And that's one of the ones that kind of stands out to me. And I did, before I knew what cultural anthropology was, I would have said that I can look back and say that that probably would have been my path had I not had pretty significant trauma during my teenage years. So we moved around a lot as a kid, and my mother took various jobs. We were in a Waldorf community for quite a while, and I, you know, went to a Waldorf school early on. I still remember that experience, making candles, singing in different languages, French and German and English, the storytelling that connected to mathematics, and just how quickly I picked it up. I can still sew and knit and all those things as a result of, you know, being exposed to that as a child. And they fostered that stuff in those schools at the time. And I think they still do today. And I'm not connected to that community. So as we moved around and, you know, as life kind of unfolds, my mother was going through her own process with undiagnosed PTSD. She had a number of experiences. She was selectively mute as a child. She was very creative. She's more of a visual processor than an auditory processor. And that meant that she leaned into the arts at the time. Later in life, during my, so she moved into education. She went back to school. I guess I was probably eight or nine, somewhere around there. And she got her master's in special education. And she started working in public schools. And about that time, things started to get difficult for us as a family. I say difficult, but I mean, what she was going through, I was hitting puberty. My dad was traveling a whole lot. And that meant that there was a lot of friction between my mother and I. And during that period of time, that friction led to like them having a really difficult time parenting me and me really resisting the parenting style that they were using. And that looked like flat out defiance of their rules and saying no a lot to things that were pretty silly in my opinion. And now, but you know, as a kid, it felt like this is the hill I'm dying on kind of thing.
It always does. I mean, that's what happens when you're a kid.
That's right. And you know, when I look back, you know, hindsight's 2020, I could say, well, I could have done that differently and I might have been parented differently as a result. And they could have been parenting differently and I might have responded differently as a result. I know they did their best given what they knew at the time. But that meant that when my dad was doing a lot of traveling, my mother just didn't know how to parent me. And she got to a point where she was so overwhelmed, she couldn't handle it. And she ended up sending me to a group home. And so it was an idle threat for a little while. And then one day, something snapped. And next thing you know, she contracted this company. It was a Christian-based organization. But she had police come and they took me. And that meant that my sense of freedom disappeared. That point, I went from living a very sheltered life. I was sheltered from the pain and the suffering of the world. I was told stories about it, but I was not exposed to it directly.
Yeah.
And so I went from this really insulated world where I'm in a loving family. There's tension and turmoil between us as a family, but I'm not exposed to the hardship and the difficulty and the dangers of others in the world. And I'm thrust into this environment where children whose parents are addicted to drugs or they're being physically or sexually abused are living in this environment because it's a safe haven for them. And I'll put safe haven in quotes. For some people, I think it might have been that, but for most of them, they were just really unhappy and court ordered to be there.
Right.
Either that or their parents had passed on and there was nowhere for them to be. They were stuck in the foster system. And so we kind of get the picture, you know, how out of place my personality and my experience was in that environment. And I was heavily picked on in that environment because I was gullible.
Right.
I had no idea that I needed to be protecting myself and buffering my emotions or any of these other things. And so that went on for a couple of years. So it was about 12 and a half, right before I was turned 13, I think it was. And between 13 and 15, so about 2 years, and those 2 years feel like a long time when you're in middle school and you're that age. I was in and out of that group home and was not allowed contact with others. I still had to go to the same school, but I had to ride a different bus, and people at the school knew that I was somewhere else. And I was really good at school prior to that. And it was interesting. I have this, my mother saved these letters. I have this letter I wrote, or not a letter, but this is what I want to do with my life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Imagining what my future might be. And I'm imagining going to UVA and then joining the military and getting involved in a tech company and these other things that are like really like embedding in society kind of ideas. And I don't even remember writing this thing, Lauren, at this point. I have no memory of this. And then a year and a half later, there's a letter from me, or maybe 2 years later, there's a letter from me to her written from this. I ended up in and out of this group home, coming home, and then I was sent to a camp for boys that was like a boot camp kind of thing. It was out in the wilderness. There was no electricity in the beginning. It was a level system. You had to be voted up by your peers. And they were the like taking guns to school, inner city kind of kids, stealing drugs and very violent. And so while there, I wrote her this letter, something about it was just jointed about being beaten unconscious and kicked and you know, telling a story about some of the horrible things that had been happening to me. Again, I don't remember writing this letter, but the contrast between these two, it was this hopeful child and then this beaten and broken child.
Yeah.
Right. And that was kind of the shift that happened inside of me. I went from this having a hopeful, being able to see a potential future, to undergoing a lot of trauma, being mostly dissociated from myself.
Yeah, surviving.
Survival mode, for sure. I mean, yeah. Physical, sexual abuse, and then psychological abuse too. And ongoing, not knowing, is there somewhere safe? No one was there to protect me.
Right.
Thankfully, in moments, I had people that showed up that would be allies for me, mm-hmm. like a counselor or one of the group leaders and things like that. But it was a wild experience, for sure. And it shaped me. I realized no one's coming for me.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I would say that's when we could say lost my faith, but it was more of a praying for support and help, and nothing's there.
Yeah.
It was just me. It was me and the environment. I had to figure it out. I had to get through it. That was the time in my life where I started finding four-leaf clovers.
Mm.
It was wild.
It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I won't go into too many of the details of things, just because the details are sensitive details and they might be hard for somebody to listen to.
Yeah.
But suffice it to say that there were periods in these experiences that were pretty intense. And I'm in the process of writing a book, and some of these, more of the details will be in that book.
Okay, good. Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. I mean, just even hearing this, I know you are a wealth of knowledge, which is one of the many reasons I wanted to have you on the show. But even just hearing this story, I'm like, wow, this is insane. How much context and how much you've gone through to get to where you are now.
Yeah, that really shaped the next phase of my life. And I think about my life in chunks, right? I had this nurturing, loving foundation. So I had a baseline to return to.
Yeah.
Many people don't have that. Mm-hmm. I had solid attachment figures in my life. So I could trust that someone would be there.
Right.
And even in the midst of going through this next phase in my teenage years, I had this mixed, very confusing message of, you're in trouble and you have to go through this,
yeah,
but we still love you.
Mm.
We're doing this because we love you. And so I had to unravel the confusion around abuse as love in disguise. And that is true for many people, especially our generation. Getting spankings, I'm doing this because I love you.
Yeah.
Are you though?
Right. Exactly.
Right. Like, nope, this is about you, I'm pretty sure. And your lack of control right now.
We could do a whole other podcast on that. We could just be here for an hour. So
talking about exactly that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and those in our generation, and it may still be happening today. I don't know, but those in our generation definitely know those words to a degree. The baby boomers had that passed on, you know, post-World War I, World War II, those parents, they used violence to train.
Right.
And I think many, many generations before did as well. It was just part of life. It was accepted. And now we know that that actually is problematic for the development of the human being.
Yeah.
And it's counterproductive for learning and trust building and building solid relationships and so on and so forth, right?
Right.
So I came out of that experience, came home, and was home for maybe 5 or 6 months. And my parents finally found out what had been going on. I'd been hit in the head with a rock and a sock hat, and I have a somewhat flat spot in my head. Although I've been working with a Rolfer recently, and my skull shape is changing. It's freaking
amazing.
Wild.
Rolf. I love Rolfing.
Oh my God, it's amazing. And this woman's in her 70s. She studied directly with Ida Rolf, was friends with Peter Levine, and immersed herself in the SE and body dynamics and a variety of other advanced body-oriented practices. Her name is Norma Bandy. If you're in Austin, Texas, look her up. Austin Holistic Health. I cannot sing her praises enough. I mean, it's just, she is an absolute wizard with working with the body.
So I love it. When I come to Austin, I'm going to have to go visit her.
I will make sure that you're able to get in to see her when you come.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Are you a high-achieving woman who is tired of swiping left and right, hoping to find the love of your life? Are you ready to break free from toxic relationships and finally create a deep, lasting connection with someone who truly aligns with your heart and soul? Well, I want to introduce you to the Align Love Collective, a transformative 6-month coaching container designed to help you find your soulmate without sacrificing your career or wasting any more time on the dating apps. In the Align Love Collective, you'll embark on a journey of self-discovery and personal growth. Our team of expert coaches and therapists will guide you through a proven process to discover the root of what's keeping you from finding your soulmate, understand how to get your nervous system in alignment with what you desire, then watch it all unfold as you implement the roadmap that will lead you straight into the arms of the one you love. But that's not all. When you join the Align Love Collective, you become a part of a supportive community of like-minded individuals, all on their own journeys to finding the love that aligns with their deepest desires. You'll receive ongoing support through live coaching sessions and exclusive resources to help you every step of the way. Plus, you'll gain access to guest experts to ensure that you have the tools that you need for success. Don't settle for anything less than the love you deserve. Join the Align Love Collective and discover the path to a healthy, lasting love. If you want to learn more, visit my website at www.laurenzoller.com/soulmate, S-O-U-L-M-A-T-E, to learn more. The Align Love Collective, where love and alignment go hand in hand.
So I come out of that, I get home, and not too long after, my parents tell us that they're considering separating. Now, it wasn't, the separation didn't happen yet. We were moving again because my father got another job offer, and it was either going to be San Francisco or Lafayette, Indiana. And he ended up opting for, I know.
Such wild, vast differences between the two.
Huge differences. So he chooses Lafayette, Indiana. I guess the offer was better financially. And so we're like, all right, we're going to up and move again. And it's about every couple of years, only we had lived in Lynchburg, Virginia for much longer. And context about Lynchburg, Lynchburg, Virginia is the home of Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell is the founder of Liberty University, which is one of the largest Christian universities on the planet. He's a televangelist and massive, massive church. Like, we're talking 12,000 people fit in that church, or maybe more at this point. And that has an influence on the culture inside of Lynchburg, Virginia. And so there was this period of growing up in that culture. And then the next period of my life was like, I discovered marijuana. I discovered weed. I'm like, holy shit, I can feel good. This is incredible. I was always told by my parents that it would destroy my brain and I'd start hallucinating and I would see weird things. Nah. I was like, why did they lie? This is great.
This is amazing. This feels incredible.
Yeah. I started experimenting with alcohol and I started smoking cigarettes around 12 or 13, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And that began my foray into dissociative avoidance of feelings. Mm-hmm. So with everything I went through, processing that was, I didn't know.
Too much.
It was too much. And I was working with a counselor for a little while, and that counselor broke the confidentiality of our container and started telling my mother and somebody else some things from inside the container. And so I lost my trust in counseling for a while at that point. So we get home, my parents are like, we're moving. And then they decide to split. They're beginning the process, or they're in conversation about separation. And my mother started seeing somebody, and my mother said my father had something to tell me. And he was beginning to come out as transgender. At the time, we didn't have that word for it. So it was just cross-dressing at the time. Mm-hmm. And so she stayed in Virginia for a little while he was getting things set up out in Indiana. And then we all moved, and I decided to stay. I wanted to stay in Virginia. And I had some friends, and we worked it out so that I could live with one of my friends and his mother. And my father would send her money every month to take care of me. She spent that money on drugs. And, you know, we'd have enough food to get by, but not a lot.
Yeah.
I didn't care at the time, though. I just wanted to be out of the household. I'm like, at that time, I started rejecting my family. And the narrative that I held was, they don't care about me. They don't love me. They're fucked up. All these things, right? Lots of judgment, lots of anger. And so that fight response started to kick up, where I started to do a push away everything that I had known. Mm-hmm. And that looked like turning towards drugs and alcohol. But it was mostly just smoking a lot of weed and drinking a lot of beer and and liquor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I dropped out of school for 6 months, well, for most of a year, actually. And then because I didn't go get myself a job, my mother was finally like, all right, you need to come home. We can't let this happen anymore. So I come home, and within a week or two, I ended up coming home after smoking some weed. And she discovered that. And at the time, no, it's not okay. And the next morning, I was on a flight to Indiana to live with my dad. And at the time, I didn't have any understanding about what my father was going through. And I was pretty scared. And yet again, it's that same rupture with mother. The you didn't do it right, I'm sending you away.
Yeah.
Like that's shown up for me in relationships throughout my life. You're going to leave. You're going to leave. You're going to leave. There's an expectation of that. And gratefully, it's very quiet nowadays.
Good.
Very small whisper, and done. I know it. That's right. And I know it when it shows up. I'm like, there you are.
I have a very similar whisper. And it's taken a long time.
Yeah.
It does. I get it.
So I go out to Indiana, and you know, I'm put back into high school, and hadn't lost my intelligence at this point. You know, I didn't even complete ninth grade. I did like correspondence packets while I was at this boot camp, this outdoor camp, the boys' home. And so I basically skipped ninth grade, and then I did a quarter of 10th grade, and then I skipped 10th, and I went into 11th grade. And when I got out to Indiana, and I ended up repeating 11th grade because I just fucked off too much. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, I can look back with more of a clinical eye and say, well, there was disorganized thinking, a result of trauma. There was dissociation. You know, there was what was called ADD at the time, but it was really more just hyper brilliance and boredom. Mm-hmm. I was just totally bored in school. And there was no real reward for me to do any sort of performing in school. You know, I'd show up and I'd do great during class, but I just wouldn't do any homework and I just didn't really give a shit.
Yeah. Yep.
So I ended up repeating 11th, doing most of 12th, dropping out and getting my GED, which I scored super high on. It was not a problem for me. But at that point, I was like, I'm going to be a rock star.
Love it.
I was horrible at guitar. I have a box of tapes.
I was about to say, there's got to be proof out there of this rock star moment in your life, which I really need to see.
I have audio tapes, like actual tapes, cassette tapes.
Oh, cassette tapes. Even better.
Of these cassette tapes of recordings of me trying to learn how to play the acoustic guitar and just the messiness that was. It's just hilarious. I was convinced, though, you know, and drugs will do this. We listen to things when we're buzzed and they just sound incredible. But then we listen to them when we're sober and we're like, what the fuck was that? Our brain's able to fill in the blank.
So much truth. So much truth to that.
If anybody's ever recorded themselves singing karaoke when they're drunk and thought they sounded amazing and then listened to it the next day, they know what they're talking about.
I know. So it's so true. Oh my God, so true.
Mm-hmm. So I'm out in Indiana and I'm living with my father and he's beginning this process of gender reassignment. And so he's going through counseling. He's beginning to integrate to dressing as a woman at home. And it took a couple of years before he was ready to do that at home. I had a mohawk. It was like a foot tall, a variety of different colors at times. I dyed my hair myself. And that thing was standing up. And I was like a hippie goth kind of, like somewhere in between. I mean, like angry at the world, but not an asshole. Just kind of trying to figure out how to
deal with
the fight response that was present in my body. Right. And so loud, angry music helped me to connect to that fight that I needed to complete.
Yeah. Just pausing there for a moment. I mean, how brilliant is that? That your body went there. Mm-hmm. Naturally, right? Even though you weren't actively in the healing process, it's like your body naturally does that.
That's right. Our system intelligently knows what we need.
Yeah.
We may not realize it, and we may not have the most productive ways of getting that need met. But nonetheless, underneath the surface, like to your point, it's seeking to get that need met. Mm-hmm. And I can reflect on that and see that now. At the time, I wouldn't have told you that at all.
Right.
I was just mad at my mom. I was mad at my dad. I didn't talk to my mom for like a year or something like that. Maybe even longer. I just totally rejected speaking to her for a while. And I got to watch my dad go through this process while I was going through my own process. Around that time, he was just one day, he was like, well, you're wearing a mohawk. I'm going to dress the way I want to dress. And we ended up having this unspoken understanding with each other where he didn't try to stop me from partying. He didn't try to stop me from rebelling. He just loved me. And it was what I needed.
Yeah.
It was the thing. And it's so funny. I actually feel a little emotional when I'm saying this right now because I don't think I've said it this way.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, I didn't realize that's what I needed, but I needed acceptance.
Right.
That unconditional, I'm here with you thing, right? Regardless. Yeah. And at the time, he needed that too. And in the beginning, I was angry and I rejected him. But then I was like, no, he's still my dad. And for the listener, I'm saying he because he's living as a man now.
Okay.
So he spent 17 years. He went through the surgery and he spent 17 years living as a woman. And it has now detransitioned and is living as a man again. And so around that time, I discovered LSD. And that became something of a, like Ram Dass, I was saying earlier, stories about Ram Dass, but when he was still Richard Alpert and he discovered LSD with Timothy Leary and they were experimenting and whatnot, I did that. I figured out the half-life was about 2 days. And on every third day, I'd take another round of LSD. We had some friends that were making it and it was just like almost a whole year of every couple of days I was dosing on LSD. I even went so far as to progressively eat 100 hits of acid while driving across the United States. And I've told this little bit of a story on a couple different podcasts. And I always use the caveat, don't fucking do this.
Do this. I'm glad you prefaced the story with that because
don't do this. Not safe. It's not good. You know, I remember watching Fear and Loathing and I'm like, yeah, I totally get this. I totally understand this. I understand the story. That's me. Yeah. We just was like, whatever it was, as long as it didn't involve a needle, I would not inject anything into my body.
Yeah.
And that foray into discovering psychedelics, in the beginning, it was a wonderful escape. And then it became a processing tool because with LSD specifically, you can't get away from your mind. It's always with you. And so I would have these long journeys of like inner turmoil and like processing of a lot of the pain and the suffering that I'd gone through. And it started to filter out into me reconciling some of the pain. And I became interested in other cultural stories, the origin of a variety of different mystical teachings and religions. And so I began experimenting with or exploring Celtic and Druidic traditions, like ancient pagan stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was when I began finally feeling safe enough to explore outside of the Christian world and not diving completely in, but learning about them, learning about all the different Abrahamic religions and some of the things that instigated, you know, the emergence of them, ancient Sumerian cultures and the Kabbalistic teachings, which were very similar to Buddhist teachings, the Egyptian mystical mystery schools and whatnot. And I started to get a hunger for learning more about the more esoteric or hidden knowledge that exists on our planet. And the internet was just starting to open up and we had torrent downloads and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I found tons of these old manuscripts that had been translated from these ancient languages. And I just started taking them in and reading them and reading them and reading them and learning. And so that kind of paired with this psychedelic exploration started to stimulate a curiosity about freedom in my body, this like transcendent kind of experience. And at the time, it was still an attempt to avoid pain. But nonetheless, that attempt to avoid pain led me towards practices that required that I process what was inside.
Yeah.
There was no turning away from it. And this like becoming pure was now on my radar as something that I wanted to pursue. So we eventually moved from Indiana, or I eventually moved. He started living in Chicago and I was living there and I had an injury to my back and started taking I manipulated the system, is how I might say it, to give me stronger pain meds. Okay. I decided I was going to stop smoking weed and drinking alcohol and just use pharmaceuticals for a while and do it legally.
Yeah, great. Great transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just kept going back and going, it's not working. And this particular doctor decided to prescribe me morphine for a back problem that I had. Now, it was a very painful back problem that I had, but I became addicted to it without realizing it.
Right. As most people do.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then my father had been taking care of me at this time, and he's like, all right, he's going to stop. And so I sold some of my prescription medicine to some friends. Mm-hmm. And unbeknownst to me, this guy that I ended up selling to he informed on me. And I didn't know. I ended up moving out of the state. And a year and 11 months later, they filed an indictment. I was already living in Virginia, had no knowledge of this. Starting a new life, had stopped selling drugs. And I sold LSD and weed and other things for a while. Just was my foray into entrepreneurship, we could say. And not proud of it at this point in my life, but also like recognizing that I was doing the best I could at the time.
Right. With what you had.
Mm-hmm, with what I had. So I began creating a business with a friend in Virginia, and we started an internet radio station. This was before Pandora Radio existed. We were in 72 countries within the first 3 months of existence.
Wow.
And it was turning into something. And I finally felt like I had a purpose. It's like, this is my idea. It's going well. I started becoming a sound engineer. And then a woman showed up in my life that was interested in me, and it created a rift between me and the guy that I was working with. And he and I had played music together and been really close for a long time. And he ended up lashing out at me and calling the police, accusing me of stealing some stuff from his place. Well, it should have been an easy, like, oh, I have the wrong computer monitor. You know, it's my stuff. But he held ton of my stuff ransom. It should have been as easy as like take the stuff to the police station and leave. I get there and they're like, put your hands behind your back. You have a warrant out for your arrest. There's 7 felony charges against you in another state. We need to lock you up and they're going to come pick you up. And I'm like, what? This has to be a mistake because I've been living here in Virginia for the past almost 2 years. And that started the next phase of another phase of my life, which was it was like I had in my mind that I was going to fuck around until I couldn't. And then I was going to go get a job in corporate America because I'm smart enough. I knew I could do it. It was just a matter of when would I want to do it?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to fuck around for a while and eventually do it. Now that was no longer an option. And I was terrified. I'm like, fuck, I'm going to end up in prison. I'm not that kind of person. But in fact, I was. I just was not aware. I couldn't see myself.
Right.
I was so dissociated from my actions and from the lifestyle I was living that I just didn't realize. And so I ended up spending a week and a half in jail and then was able to bond out. We got an attorney and I didn't end up having to spend any time in prison, but they did sentence me to 14 years, all suspended, and I had to be on probation for 6.
Wow.
And it was terrifying. And my system is still reverberates from the fear. I talk about a traumatizing experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, all of your rights in every way are just stripped away from you by the government.
Yeah.
All of my privacy was gone. They have my voice print. They have my fingerprints. They have my DNA. There's no privacy at all as a human being. And from having my privacy taken as a child to then as an adult having it stripped away from me again, there was this massive like feeling of a lack of safety in the world.
Right.
Like, where is there that is safe? There isn't anywhere.
Right. Which is such a running theme that we see in anyone that is incarcerated in that same position, right? There is no safety. There's never been safety.
No, there's not, usually. And those environments where they end up are the antithesis of safety.
Right.
Like, there is no safety in those environments at all.
Yeah.
And I got to experience some of that firsthand. Thankfully, I didn't have to be in a prison. It was just in a county jail for a period of time. So during the next 6 years, I lived in a tent. I worked construction a little bit. I started integrating into a small part of the community in Virginia. I eventually was able to come back to Virginia and we had everything transferred there. Thankfully, because Indiana is a police state and it's much harder out there.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting the raw story.
I love this. This is so great. I'm loving it. Loving it.
The first time publicly to tell all these details.
I love it.
So I had to find a place to integrate. And I started working at a bar. I worked as a bouncer. I did a little bartending. I started doing sound engineering and then started working with a theater company. And that gave me a window into possibility. I could still work with music, but I wasn't gifted enough as a musician to be a leader of a band. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't met the people to really cut my chops well enough to be a player in a band. But I could run sound. And as a sound engineer, the band was my instrument. And so it was mixing and bringing everything together. And I started to get fairly good at it. And I partnered up with a band and a guy that I really believed in. I started pouring my heart and soul into growing his band and small tours, regional tours. I went back to school for anthropology and went back to college. I didn't end up finishing it. Just again, I found myself in the same situation where it's like, this is fucking, why do I have to do all of this before I get to the cool shit? Like, what's wrong with our institutions?
So it's so real though. So real.
So real. But I was very self-motivated to learn about certain things. And so, you know, back in even 2000, when I was still just graduating high school, I discovered Carl Jung's work. And that, along with the mystic arts and whatnot, really fed that part of me that was interested in the psyche, the unconscious, the spirit, spirituality, leadership, development, personal development, change. These are all words that we use in our industry right now to describe these things that are, they use very different words and language to describe. But discovering Jung really early was a huge help for me, helped me mm-hmm. to understand myself and self-reflect internally and analyze some of the thoughts and the behaviors.
That wraps up today's episode of the Aligned Love Podcast. One thing that would really help me and the other new potential listeners is for you to rate this show and leave a comment wherever you tune in and listen. Also, make sure to link up with me on Instagram at Lauren Zoller, and please share this podcast with anyone who you think may enjoy it. Until next episode, remember, every transformation begins with one moment of awareness, and I hope today has been yours. I'll see you next time.